The great philosopher Kierkegaard said, "Life can only be understood backwards, but it must be lived forwards." Looking back only results in learning for people who have that time to think, and many of us are so busy with day-to-day demands that we rarely have time to reflect. And that's why we started What I Wish I Knew. It's for those moments when you realize that just a bit of insight might have come in handy if you had it in advance. I'm Mike Irwin.
And I'm Simon Dorr. So we talk with people from all walks of life, from startup entrepreneurs to Fortune 500 CEOs, professional athletes to weekend warriors, from artists and designers to even engineers who became designers, from those who dream to those who dream, then actually do. They all have three things in common. None are perfect. All are humble and each have truly incredible learnings. In What I Wish I Knew, they share these lessons with you.
Well, welcome to this episode of What I Wish I Knew with Mike Irwin and Simon Dorr. We are honored today to have Eric Thomas with us. And Eric is an entrepreneur, a storyteller, a social commentator, a brand strategist, an artist, and a designer. And he's a bit of everything, and you'll hear that in this through this conversation. He's senior partner at storytelling agency Saga in Detroit, and he's chief storyteller of the city of Detroit, which I think is fascinating. He's also an in-demand speaker who's spoken in front of many groups, and his blog on LinkedIn has achieved more than 3 million reads. So he's got a lot to say in person and in his writing, and we are we're honored to have this opportunity to speak with Eric. So Eric, welcome to What I Wish I Knew.
Thank you for having me. Everything's so virtual now. It's like I'm here, but I'm also at home. But thank you for having me.
So without getting too deep, how did you get here?
I stumbled aggressively. I don't know. One day, my dad told me a story when I was younger, and he made this joke. He said, the weirdest thing about me is I've always known who I am. Like, even as a little kid, like, I've always just been like, this is what I'm doing. And if I don't want to do it, I'm not doing it. And if you're doing something I don't want to do, I'm not. Small tense on that. Like, I've never tasted alcohol or tried cigarettes or anything. I've just never been tempted. Peer pressure has never been my thing. And so when I started, I decided I wanted to do what it is I wanted to do. So I spent a lot of time not making any money, right? I stumbled into graphic design because I was doing it in a class. And then I failed that class because I wouldn't do the homework because I was just doing what I wanted to because I thought it was fascinating. I had to take the class again. By that time, I was outperforming the teacher. Teacher had me teaching the other kids. And I failed the class again because I wasn't doing the homework. Then I went to community college and filled out a community college because I wouldn't do my homework because I'm just bad at homework. I graduated high school with a 1.8 GPA or something like that. Then dropped out of community college to kind of run my own little marketing, my own graphic design kind of thing on freelance side. And I've been just kind of stumbling through. I met a business partner who is actually great at business. He's been running businesses since he was in middle school. And you hear that and you go, what was he doing? Well, I think he had a record label in middle school. If you want to talk to somebody, he's an interesting person to talk to. And so he's the one who got me really more focused on business and thinking about it in the context of what I can do. I've actually never wanted to be a business owner. I've never been interested. But working, it's hard to be lazy when your business partner gets up every day at 4 a.m, works a whole job at a bank, works the whole day, does work for your business before he goes to work, does a full day, comes with you and works until midnight. At some point you start going, maybe I need to get on my P's and Q's. So working with him for many, many years, about 8-9 years, really kind of changed my perception of how work would impact the world. Over that time, I learned design and marketing and branding and strategy, much through trial and error. And I picked up so many skills along the way, I couldn't figure out what to call myself. Because at that point, I wasn't a graphic designer or a brand strategist anymore. And I was a public speaker and I started writing because I read somewhere David Ogilvy said, you might want to learn how to write. And so I was like, well, let me give it a shot. 2 or 3 months into that, my writing starts going viral on LinkedIn. And, you know, I got 1 million views on a blog or something like that. And I started getting asked to write for magazines. I've been quoted in the New York Times, all kind of stuff. I'm doing quotes in Ad Week. I'm like, what in the hell is going on? You know, what is happening? And then sometime in 2019, I became really disillusioned with everything. It's just working for clients is not creative. It's just, you're just making stuff. And I just got exhausted and I just stopped working. I decided I wasn't going to do anything that I didn't want to do, much like I did when I was a kid. And then I got really, really poor because, you know, you don't work, you don't make money. And I got offered this job December 2019 to be the chief storyteller for the city of Detroit. And for a person who was a fierce advocate for Detroit residents and low-income communities and diverse populations, and who's been masquerading as a storyteller, I guess, for 5 years up to that point, to be offered chief storyteller of the city you live in, which is a major city, I turned it down like 3 times. But one of my mentors was like, are you insane? And so then I took that job, and I've been in it for about a year and 2 months at this point.
So you're a guy who wrote an article that called I Hate Detroit.
Yeah, why I hate Detroit. And now I'm a chief storyteller for the city of Detroit.
But he got an audience, yeah, Eric.
Our mayor is a very interesting guy. He does two tactics that I'm really impressed by. A, he'll forge partnerships with his critics. Right? He figures if you're brave enough to criticize him, you're brave enough to tell him what he's doing wrong. And that's kind of how I take it. And he often hires people who have been very critical of him. I mean, some people could see it as a neutralizing tactic if I wasn't an absolute psycho, because I'm still commenting on things and talking about stuff I don't like and commenting on police brutality and all these sorts of things. And I haven't been fired yet, shockingly enough. But it's a testament to, I think, his foresight and understanding that criticism is an attack, right? Unless it is. But mine hasn't been against the mayor. It's just been against the system. And so when I wrote that article, you notice I don't mention the mayor's name. I don't mention any politicians. I think when you put systemic racism on a person, you're giving a person too much credit, right? Like, it's not the, like, no one person has subjected all the Black people, you know, to oppression, right? It is a system that's been perpetuated that creates this dissonance. And the minute you boil it down to a person, or the minute I say, well, racism is a thing, you say, oh, well, I'm not doing anything, you're taking too much damn credit, right? Like, and so that's the same way that I look at the city of Detroit, which is, you know, are incredibly poor and has been, but doing a lot better now, right? We've lowered the poverty rate by 10% in, you know, 5 years or whatever. Like, it's incredible. And you see us moving out of poverty, but it's not the poor people's fault. It's not the current administration's fault. It's 60, 70 years, 100 years of focused effort. And so it just creates that kind of tension. And I think that is how I ended up in a job like this, just my understanding of it and my ability to communicate it in a way that not only the people going through it tend to hear, but also people who normally are closed to the idea of that tend to be receptive to the message when done right. And if they don't, screw them. Personally, I don't care. I'm not here to ego stroke races, fuck y'all. But it is, that's how I look at it.
So talk about that then. I mean, it's depressing on the one hand, you know, systemic racism and its long-term effects that we still see, you know, today in, you know, massive ways. But then where is it that you find, where do you find hope?
You know, it's complicated. So when you look at the world on the whole, the world is a better place than it has been ever in history for any group of people anywhere. More education, more access for women, more access for Black people, more access for poor people, more people moving out of poverty than ever before, longer lifespans than ever, more access to technology, growing and increasing. I mean, the world is marching forward in a way that is, on the whole, positive. But better than horrible is not good. So that is always what I like to remind people, because usually people use that argument to say, well, you're not in slavery anymore. It's kind of like if I shot you, then stabbed you, Right. It's like, well, I didn't shoot you again. It's like, bro, like you still stabbed me. It's still bad. And so I do know that with force, progress happens. But progress does not happen without action. It does not happen without pushing it along. Inertia is just that way. The status quo will remain the status quo until somebody pushes it forward. It's always been that way. You know, racism hasn't left America because people got nicer. You know, like people went to war to stop slavery from ending. Then we opened up, and then Jim Crow happened after. Like it was the Renaissance and then Jim Crow. It wasn't Jim Crow, then the Harlem Renaissance, then all this other kind of stuff, then Reconstruction. It didn't go. Like Confederate statues were built 50 to 100 years after the slave, after the Confederacy existed. And so it really goes like this. And so our understanding must be to keep our eyes on the backslide. When you understand history well enough to see that certain rhetoric, like a "Make America Great Again," right, was Reagan, right? Like it's the same phrasing and the same rhetoric used over and over and over again. For instance, there's a show called Warrior about kind of Chinese immigration in the 1800s, and you see the Irish were turned against Chinese immigrants by saying these people are going to take your jobs. Well, that sounds incredibly familiar. So then the Irish people turned on the poor Chinese people and they attacked them and they burned down Chinatowns. And then it was all this assault and there was these wars and they were killing Chinese people to fight for their jobs. Well, then I see rhetoric that I see Black people turning against Hispanic people saying that they're taking their jobs, or poor white people mad at Mexicans for taking their jobs. It was like, this sounds shockingly familiar. Would you like to watch this movie or read this book to see what's going on? That it's, I just know, me, it's not about hope. I think if you watch any of my stuff, it's about, you know, it's that bitter optimism. I don't believe that things are just going to get better. I think it's our job to make things better. Mm.
So Eric, talk about that. I mean, that's a fascinating point that you made. And I think you had this philosophy that, you know, this might be bad, but it can be better. Tell us about that.
You know, we have a great deal of privilege to have time to think about rights, right? Like if you really think about it, you know, ducks aren't thinking about the rights of all ducks, and monkeys aren't really putting together abolitionist movements for beta monkeys versus alpha monkeys. And, you know, there's a great deal of privilege that comes with that, but also to even have the time to sit up here and have a podcast discussion about access in the theoretical sense is something that many humans don't have the privilege to do because they've got to feed these kids. And so that's why I always think about how things can get better. And to reflect back on the opportunities that I have, even growing up poor, even growing up low income, knowing that at bare minimum, there are people in my family that introduced me to knowing that there was more. So I could be discontented with my reality, right? I take it as a special privilege to be discontented because some people don't know there is better. Right. And at the same time, you flip that on its head. Is that good? Right. Joy seems to be connected to your expectation. So when you see these censuses of the world and like who are the happiest population, it tends to be these groups of people that are so far flung that have less and they're just full of joy. Hmm. You don't have this like, damn, I wish I had Ariana Grande's salary. You know, it's not this consistent comparative nature. And so when I think about it, I have this weird balance where I'm trying to figure out, okay, I do want to make the world better for the people that are in it. And I want to create opportunities for people that don't have access to things, but I want to do it in a way that people don't think that the state of their oppression is their fault, right? So that there's not always this dissonance in maybe I belong here, nor is there any decision that you made that's your fault. Everybody doesn't have to be an entrepreneur. I'm so tired of this entrepreneurship cult where it's like everybody, oh, well, why are you building somebody else's dream? Yeah. Hell, maybe my dream is just to go home to my kids. Mm-hmm. Right? You don't have to want to run a Fortune, you know, 500. That's a lot of stress. If you're happy at you know, $45,000, $50,000, you can take care of your kids, you can give them the opportunity they want, more power to you. And that's what I mean by like, it's bad, but it could be better. The world's not good for everyone.
Yeah.
But it's great for
so some. Eric, yeah, just and just on that, you know, you come across here as truly, you know, energy and passion and I guess the other theme and something that we want to talk about is this purpose. And you know, I guess I call you a professor of purpose. so I'd be truly interested, because you know, it is a kind of buzzword out there right now. I really enjoy your take on purpose, what it means, and how you do it the best.
So I grew up in church for a long, so I was an active member of the church until I was like 20, maybe 22, and I became agnostic, and I became atheist, which is like a weird little wind. And I live in a city that's very religious, and I come from a family that's pretty religious, and I have a lot of friends that are pretty religious, and I have friends from a lot of religious spectrums, and we talk about this. But then there's a flip side where I have a friend who's very depressed and deals with heavy depression, suicidal ideation, and they'll ask me, why? And that's different. It's interesting when you talk to people who have religious certainty. We need to do this because there is certainty. But when you talk to somebody who suffers some great deals of depression and they're suicidal, and they'll tell you, I don't see the purpose to even exist. Usually you could say to somebody, well, don't you want to live? When that answer is no, it makes you think very deeply about what it means to exist. And so I actually had fallen in love with that person. And so it really, there's real tension there. So one day we were having a conversation and it hit me. For me, the most interesting thing about being a human is choice. You can decide that your purpose is whatever you want it to be, right? If you decide to live for Galapagos turtles, that's on you, right? And you can do that with as much passion as someone who is going to paint the Sistine Chapel, right? The really interesting thing about purpose is that it is simultaneously absolutely nothing at all and absolutely everything. Right, like it is nebulous. It is attached to nothing. It means nothing. It's completely arbitrary. For instance, somebody shoots at me, and I'm like, oh, but my purpose, right? Like you're gonna die, right? It doesn't really matter how you feel about it. But because of all of that, you can aim at it, and you can define what your purpose is for yourself, and you can march towards that purpose with as much energy as anybody marches towards anything. And so that for me has been a really driving force, because it also allows me to release things that other people think are important. Some stuff I just don't care about. I don't care about gossip. I don't chase after girls in the same way that I think a lot of people do. I'm not distracted by the trappings of luxury, even though I want a Rolls Royce and all these fancy things and my house looks like a museum or whatever the hell. But I do it for me, right? And that's much different than I think people realize that they can live. Like, you can live for yourself. I've been wearing a suit every day since 12th grade. And everybody's like, yo, why are you dressed up? Because I like how I look in suits. And that's it. That's the entire answer. And that's how I look at purpose.
So how does it work then? You've delivered, you know, interestingly, bits here that relate to self-purpose and single purpose. And how does that become a collective?
I mean, I think making the world better for everybody is actually a very selfish endeavor, right? Because if everybody's doing well, then everybody's doing well, right? If everybody has money to spend, then all the people at the top would actually make more money. The gluttonous absorption of wealth is very silly, because if everyone in China was living well, then anyone who served China would be rich as hell, right? Like if everybody in America, like if you didn't have 30% of the people some in some places in poverty, then people would be able to go shopping, and those people that they're shopping with would be able to sue your services. And more so, you look at the fight for like, for seats at the top of organizations, right? Well, if we give all these women, these minorities, this access, blah, blah, blah. Well, if everybody had money, there'd be more businesses. There'd be more seats for more people to fill.
A bigger table.
And, you know, this is just the numbers of it all, right? The gluttonous hoarding of it, and believing that these seven people should have all of this stuff. Because one day I'll be Jeff Bezos. It's like, no, you're not. Like you're not. Right. You're much more likely to be the pretty wealthy guy that owns a chain of oil, you know, mechanic shops than you are to be Jeff Bezos. So spread it all out and let everybody run the oil shops. Other than like having like six Jeff Bezos isn't like then everybody's like feeding off scraps because one day, one day we'll all be Jeff. And that's kind of, I mean, honestly, it's a selfish way to look at caring about everybody. But if everybody was good, then everybody be good.
That's interesting because you also talk a little bit about, I mean, about comparison, you know, and social media probably has made this even worse than in prior generations because people appear to be living a life that they may not be living and everybody can kind of compare. You know, it's the keeping up with the Joneses kind of, you know, mentality that if someone has the nice car, the nice house, or, you know, then I want it too. But what you just said is when you talk about purpose, you're talking about living for yourself. You're talking about internalizing it rather. It's really just for you.
It's for me. How long have we been obsessed with that, right? Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous, you know, was a thing. We loved, putting on the Ritz, right? Dressed up like a $1 million trooper, trying hard to look like Gary Cooper, super duper, right? Like we've always been obsessed. I mean, all back to kings and oligarchs and all other sorts of things, just the lifestyles of the rich and famous. Yes, I do believe that there's something very reality warping about Instagram because it makes it look like everybody's rich. At least back in the day, you could be like, look, it's Gary Cooper, right? We're not all going to be fine. Now it's just like, Jesus, Sarah from down the street just went to Cancun. They didn't tell you that they got a cheap ticket on skip lag and then went down there and stayed with a friend and they all split an Airbnb and they all slept on the floor. They went to the beach and took two or three pictures. Like no one told you that. and now you've warped it right now. Now everyone's got clear skin because there's filters and everybody's teeth is incredibly white. And it's impressive. But at the same time, who cares? I talk to young people all the time. I'm just like, okay, here's the question for me. What happens when you have it? Like, I like Rolls Royces because I've been in a Rolls Royce, right? And they're very nice. It's like, Jesus, I want one of these. But you're comparing yourself to pictures of experiences. And so the question is, there are more than enough people who are in great pictures than jumped off a bridge right after. You have to ask yourself, what is the joy that you're seeking? What actually makes you happy? And it's okay for the things that make other people happy to not make you happy. I found out a long time ago, I'm not a womanizer. Not my deal. You know, every time I got in a breakup, my friends like, you should go sleep around. I was like, nah, I respect women. Sorry about that. I was raised by all women. I don't think I want to use them for my own pleasure just to feel better about myself no matter what happens to them, right? And when I realized that about myself, it was easier for me to just reject the social norms of toxic masculinity, all these other kind of things. It's not that I don't like women. I am attracted to women. I am not attracted to the idea that they should be reduced to objects for the pleasure of myself. And I'm also not interested in capitulating to other men who are making jokes or doing things or taking advantage of women in a way that I fit in with their group. So I often get these arguments with dudes because you know how men are. They start bragging to you about things that you're like, that's borderline rape, my guy. But because we've been perpetuating these things, we start to think, am I supposed to like what they like? Mm-hmm. Am I supposed to be like them? Am I the one that's strange? because I'm not finding enjoyment. And so you find people living these like pseudo realities, and then they create these duplicitous identities where with somebody, they're a whole nother person. I joke, it's like when you hang out with a friend from another country and then they're with their family and an accent appears out of nowhere that you've never heard before in your entire life. It's like, wait, you're from Mexico? You know, like you didn't even know, right? It's because you split your identity into pieces. Mm-hmm. Code switching is like that. I've never been a code switcher. I'm lucky that the way that I speak kind of fits in both worlds. So I speak with a bit of Ebonics, I speak with a bit of slang, I speak kind of collegiately, I speak in all these different ways. But it's not necessarily different, give or take a word or two that I drop when I'm in mixed company. But I try not to get your show censored. But usually I don't change the way that I present. And it's because I'm just happy with myself. And I'm not interested in people who would censor me. Right. If you decided that I can't be on your show because of the way that I act or the things I say, if I'm going to talk about racism, which I will on your whoever show, or talk about misogyny or toxic masculinity or whatever this stuff, then you're just going to have to cut me out of the show. And that's what internalizing that purpose allows you to do. And it's kind of scary. It was scary when I was younger. It's just less scary now.
And just then on the definition of purpose, and you know, clearly values of different people, you know, gender, age, whatever, can be very different. And we talked just before the show about the workplace, and that's that kind of mixed piece of purpose, maybe at senior team level versus you know the rest of the organization. Just explain a bit about that, because I guess purpose can be good and bad.
Yeah, you know. Here's the thing about company culture, right? Here's the frustrating thing about company culture. When company culture is defined by a rigid set of mores, defined by people who are homogenous, company culture just becomes how me and my friends are, right? So if your entire executive leadership is white dudes from one place, what you're going to do is you're going to start screening people out that don't feel like you guys. And you're going to say things like, well, they just didn't fit with the culture. Right? It makes sense that if everybody here is from the Hamptons, that some guy from Chicago, you know, a Puerto Rican dude from the Bronx doesn't fit in with the company culture. Doesn't mean he can't do the job. He just don't fit with the culture. Right? What that means is I don't get to make weird racial jokes anymore because I have to check myself if that person is around. I can't have a woman in the cabinet meeting if we're going to be joking about what ladies do or how emotional they are. How can we give a woman an executive position? That's not in HR or diversity, right? If that person's the accountant, now all of a sudden they have a say in what we're doing. And so the idea of, that's why I always say, like, when you talk about company culture, as if the company is a living, breathing thing, as if it has an identity, you take the onus of acting right off of the people, right? Sometimes we probably should stop being assholes. Like maybe our company culture is we're some kids and we've been acting like jerks and we've never been checked. A lot of people don't even know that what they're doing is messed up because they've never been challenged because their circle is homogenous, right? And so the real importance of creating a purpose for a company is that it should be able to evolve with the addition of people who have expanded values. That's when you have an entity that's evolved, that's allowed to grow. Then it's able to respond to the changing realities of the society we live in. And that to me, I think is the most important. That's why I get weird when people are like, we need to enshrine our values into the constitution of our organization. It's like the values are the same in every organization. Like if you read them, it's like the same seven buzzwords: diversity, inclusion, revenue, customers are always right, don't punch a kid in the mouth. You know, it's like these like very clear, obvious, you know, things. The question for me is, what happens when your company value is to evolve? Right? Then what does that mean? To absorb value from the world that we live in. What does that mean? You know, and then you get to have interesting conversations.
But that's uncertain though, Eric, right? You know, part of this is, you know, people are throwing down anchors. They call it values, they call it culture, they call it purpose. And, you know, but they're throwing down an anchor.
Yeah, I mean, in a world that's so uncertain, you got to make something certain. But,
you know, there's a term people talk about with authenticity and the idea that people or companies are real to something. But what I hear you saying, though, is almost something different, that what companies should go back to is, what do they exist for? And that part of it is authentic. But if they take their message to say, oh, well, we make soda, but we're going to change the world in some way, you're saying that's kind of drifting out of their,
you know, the reality. We're bringing about world peace. I mean, if you want to do it, you can do it. I mean, I have a presentation I do a lot called The Authenticity Lie. I think people, I'm this is why I'm the bad marketing guy. Because I don't think people care about authenticity at all. I think people care about emotional truth, right? So if you make me feel something that's real, which you can do, which happens in Spider-Man movies and Narnia and Lord of the Rings and Pikachu or whatever the hell, like, you can make someone feel an emotional, something emotionally resonant in a fiction. But I'm so tired of businesses trying to tell me that they honestly care about me. Like, Nike put Kaepernick on an ad and still had sweatshops. He's like, how much do you care about injustice? Like, Apple had people in factories making Apple products jumping off the roof to die, and the answer that they came up with was put more nets up to catch the people so they don't hit the ground. Like, was that the solution? But they've got these commercials where people are like dancing around, like, look at the joy that we bring. It's like, what are you talking about, guys? The question for me is always about consistency. I think the world responds to consistency, not necessarily authenticity. Consistency creates its own type of world building, right? If you watch an X-Men movie, for instance, nothing in the X-Men movie is real. But if a character who is supposed to walk through walls starts to fly when you know in the comic book they can't fly, we'll be like, this is fake. They're not saying it's fake. They're saying it's inconsistent with the world that we're creating. That's what we care about in business. Consistency in the world you've created. I don't believe for a damned minute that many of these corporations care about all of these impoverished groups. They just don't want to be decimated on Twitter. But if that is the case, now our job is for you to have the most impact with your grandiose, trivial statements, right? If you're going to enter this territory of racial equity and gender equality and all of these different things, then do it right. Right, do it in a way that really truly matters and say, hey, people who work here, I want you to embody these values. Here are the steps that we're taking towards that. And so now we can say, look at us. We are a company that sells pot, but we are full of people who believe in these truths. And these are the actions we're taking towards that effort. That to me would feel more realistic than saying Coca-Cola believes in equity. Coca-Cola doesn't believe in a damn thing. Coca-Cola is a piece of paper and a logo. That's it.
But on that note, though, Eric, don't you think, though, that some organizations felt the pressure to respond? You know, 2020 was a nightmare year in so many ways. And in some ways, I mean, what we saw then was companies saying more and appearing to care more than government did.
Shout out to them. I mean, I'm happy that they... How long had Kaepernick been kneeling before they joined us on the Black Lives Matter train? How long did it take people to even post the Black Lives Matter after we posted Black Lives Matter? Yeah. Now we've got Stop Asian Hate. How long does it take? Chinese people have been abused since 1875. You know, the question for me is, I'm happy that you're here, right? I'm happy that you've joined the fight. But don't pretend that you've always been in the fight. The NFL is hilarious. What? You got $100 million fund now? Like, you were the ones. but then you see, what's his name? Goodall, who said, like, I wish we would have listened to Kaepernick sooner. Us too. The dude didn't do anything. Dude literally just didn't stand up. That's all he did. And the reason he didn't stand up is because a Marine told him not to. They're like, oh, you're disrespecting the soldiers. The soldiers told him to do it, right? It is flabbergasting. And once again, it takes you back to that place where you realize that it wasn't the company's job to take a stand. It was the CEO's job to take a stand.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying? That's different because all of the companies, because you know who is a company that's really about their life? Ben and Jerry's. Ben and Jerry's, if you go on Ben and Jerry's Instagram right now, they are talking about racial equity. There's nothing going on news. There's all this stuff that's going on with people attacking Asian folks. But if you go back 2 weeks, they were talking about racial equity then. You go back a month and a half, they were talking about racial equity then. If you talk about, you know, if you keep going back, Ben and Jerry's has been and is continuing to talk about this stuff when it is popular and when it isn't popular. That there's a consistent through line. And that's because Ben and Jerry's has owners who care about this stuff. Because here's the thing, Ben and Jerry's ice cream doesn't care about the rest of us. It's ice cream. Mm. We're eating it. Mm. We're literally murdering the food, right? Like, you know, it is the ownership. And when the ownership changes, that's the real testament in whether or not it remains that way.
Yeah.
And that's what I always wonder. You look at something like Apple, right? Steve Jobs had an innovation slant. Does Apple believe in innovation or does Steve Jobs believe in innovation? When Steve Jobs passed and went to Tim Cook, look at the mission statement. The mission statement for Apple used to be something along the lines of creating the most innovative products to make life better for people. The new mission statement is something like to make the best iPods, iPads, iMacs, and computers, right? It's very specific. But why is that? Because Tim Cook is a supply chain manager. And so it's now taking on the values of a supply chain manager. It's making more money than it's ever made. It's doing more than it's ever done. It's expanding faster than it's ever expanded, but it's not making new stuff because the value was not in the business. It was in the leadership.
So I want to go back on the storytelling front and talk a little bit about that in a sense of, you know, community level and the power of storytelling to engage and transform. And, you know, we talked about that a little bit from a brand standpoint. How do you see it from a community standpoint? And if you use either Detroit or the US as a lesson, is there hope or are we doomed?
I mean, I think the United States is a textbook case of storytelling used at its greatest, most optimum efficiency, right? People come to America like that is where you go to succeed. That's been ingrained in like the world's understanding since like 1776. Like we did the Constitution and they were like, cool, everybody's gonna go to America, like to succeed. And you look at these movies of people who came to America and they were treated abysmally, right? The Irish communities, all the immigrant community, the Hungarian communities, Chinese communities, the Arab American community, all these folks come over here and they get treated like crap. And you ask them, like, how do you feel about this? Like, look, the American dream. It's like, what the hell is going on? It's like, there's almost like a dissonance. Like, people are getting beat up in the street and they're still like, this is the American dream. It's like, what is happening? We've embodied this story of American exceptionalism to the point where it's killing us, right? We're like, hey, guys, I think we're falling behind the entire world in math scores. I mean, we're like 33 in the entire world in math scores. And we're like, no, man, America's number one. So what are you talking? Like, we're literally not number one. There are numbers. There are data. It tells you right here that you're not number one. It's like, I hear what you're saying, but we are number one. In what? What are we number one in? America is number one in size of military, for sure. And probably the most wealthy people, right? We got all the super rich people. Though China is creating a billionaire a day, maybe five, something like that. Like that number is nuts, right? And so the question, are we winning in mobility or upward mobility still? Maybe, right? But the story of it, right? Once again, that consistent narrative creates inertia that is hard to roll back. America will probably lose dominance before the story of America's dominance goes away. Because we've had 300 years of one perpetuated narrative, right? The question for us is, when are we able to separate fact from narrative, from story? But it does tell you the power of story, right? It shows you that you can get people to live, fight, and die for an idea by using a story that resonates closely. The American story, I think, is really unique and special because it's duplicitous. It tells you pretty specifically that you are great because you are an American, which creates a web. It meshes us together, right? We are great. But it also tells you that you are an individual entity comprised of greatness, imbued from you from the soil of America. And now you deserve everything you've gotten because you are incredible. So now we are somehow a collective whole and an individual entity. And so you see it in conversations about healthcare, well, versus military. We are America, we deserve everything, we are the best. We are Americans, look at our flag. No, I should not pay for people to have healthcare. They need to take care of themselves. How is that the same guy? How is this guy say we are great because we are together, we fight together, we stand together, we are brothers, we are sisters, we are America, we are in this together, you have to fend for yourself. And so once again, the power of story, right, is that it doesn't have to make sense. It has to be emotionally true. You know what that story tells you? It says, you are great. You should feel good about yourself. Well, I like to feel good about myself. Fantastic. Really great storytelling burrows down in your consciousness. That's why the hero's tale is this consistent story that's used over and over again in storytelling. The hero always starts as a guy just like you. It doesn't start off with like some really great dude. Like, you know, it doesn't start off with like Hercules usually. And Hercules starts off pretty regular. Normally it starts off with like some Harry Potter kid who's just like hanging out and he's having a bad time and he can't lift a basketball because he's so frail. And if you just stick with it enough, because he is special and you are special. The main character is what they call the audience surrogate, right? The audience surrogate means that you go through the rise of what the heroes are. That's why in every single movie, they lose. Because you lose sometimes. And then you can say, I remember what that was like. I remember when I was Superman fighting an intergalactic threat. You know, I was like, do you? It's like, yeah, but I did. But then they add a really human element. Maybe he's Superman, but he's having trouble with his girlfriend. He's like, well, I have trouble with my girlfriend. I think I understand Superman now. No, you don't. He's an alien, right? The emotional resonance of that, that is the value of storytelling. When you forget that there needs to be a human element, that's when you see these big blockbuster movies fall apart. There can be as many explosions as you want to. But if I don't relate to anybody in the scenario, You ever watch a movie where at the end of the movie, like the minute you stand up in a theater, you've forgotten the entire movie? You've just forgotten the whole deal. That's how brands are existing right now, right? Like they do this stuff. They build these giant damn commercials. They spend $5 million. They get every celebrity they can find. The commercial goes off and you immediately have forgotten it. You don't know what happened. But Nike commercials don't have that problem. Because Nike commercials almost always follow the hero journey. Almost always. Like, think about a Nike commercial. Starts just like this. Boom, doom. I know life has been hard for you. Doom, boom, doom, doom, doom. And so then they like fall down. It's like rain on their face and shit. Right? Like, you know, they're just going and you're breathing hard. The music's rising. And then it's like, but we know there's an athlete living in you. And they like look up. It's doom. No matter what happens, you can always blah, blah, blah. They're just running at top speed. Just do it. It's like, holy shit. It's like, what? Every Nike commercial is that commercial. Everyone. And we love all of them. We eat it up every time. Apple is another good one where they do a very similar thing. With Apple products, there is a common challenge. And that common challenge is solved with Apple products. I need to make a song. I want to do something for my grandmother. I want to give somebody a Christmas present. I want to record my own song. I want to have a great day in the street. I want to block out the world, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, this is you. This is your audience surrogate. Yeah. Now with Apple products, at the end, the life is infinitely better. Well, what happened in the middle? Apple happened in the middle, right? It's this very simple thing. And so now we're like fighting and killing each other over Nikes and Apple products. Android users are terrorists, right? It's like, are you sure? It's like, why are you fighting your best friend over a phone choice? Because the story is now resonating more deeply than the product. Because we have embodied the narrative of it. Yeah. That is why I'm so interested in storytelling.
How do you then apply that? You know, like if, you know, think about kind of the what I wish I knew angle on this. What should someone, you know, think about is, you know, storytelling as a, you know, we talked about it in brands, we talked about it as organizations. If I'm an individual, can I write my own story? Can I tell my own story? Is it locked up in the whole myth thing?
I mean, this is something I've discovered in the world, especially because for me, becoming a storyteller was an experiment for the most part. In fact, most of my career has been the product of a really strange experiment. And it started when I started doing graphic design. I remember seeing all these people getting jobs that I wasn't getting and who weren't necessarily better than me. They were just getting these jobs. Or I would see people that I knew, all of a sudden they were an entrepreneurial coach or something like that. I was like, that guy's never even run a business. I was like, what happens if I just tell people I'm a brand strategist? Is anybody going to question me? And some people do. Brand strategists, right? Brand strategists will challenge you and storyteller experts will challenge you, but most people in the world won't. And it's this weird thing. We live in this very non-confrontational society. Who's going to be like, get on stage and be like, I don't agree with you on stage. And so you can consistently, and I do it in a way. Now, here's the thing. I believe absolutely everything that I'm talking about. But I'm still shocked that nobody's ever stopped me in one of my authenticity lie presentations I've done on these stages and these 200, 300, 400, 500 people in the audience. Only twice has somebody ever stopped me after I got off stage and be like, I don't agree with that. You have been fed that authenticity is the secret to marketing for 25 years. A 30-year-old just got on stage and told you that everything you know about marketing is not true. And none of you guys decided, screw that guy? Now, I welcome those conversations because usually after I talk about what I mean by it, because you know, people are like, I guess that does make sense. I just had that conversation on LinkedIn literally 2 days ago because I had a marketing guy go. He was like, yo, authenticity is super important. I was like, it's not. And then we got into the thing and he goes, well, actually, thank you for diving into that, blah, blah, blah. But the myth of yourself should be formed by yourself if that's what you want to do. Kanye West told everybody he was the greatest of all time long before he was the greatest of all time. Now he's the richest black man ever, ever, right? Like that doesn't, like people gotta put that in context. When Kanye West first told people he wanted to be a rapper, they laughed Kanye out of rooms. They said, Kanye West, you're not a rapper. Jay-Z told Kanye West he wasn't gonna be a rapper. Jay-Z signed Kanye West. Then Kanye said, I'm a fashion designer. Everyone said, Kanye, you are not a fashion designer. What are you talking about? The bulk of Kanye's wealth as the richest black guy ever is from fashion design. What is going on? Kanye West defined the mythology of Kanye West by himself. Wow. And now we believe Kanye West. Donald Trump is another one of these people. He said, I am going to be the president. We did not believe him. Even people who liked Donald Trump didn't believe him. When I don't even think Donald Trump fully believed it. He was in the seat for a couple of weeks before he was like, damn, I'm the president. Right? Like for a minute, he was kind of chill for the first couple of weeks. Like, yo, am I really the president? They didn't even have a cabinet picked out. Think about that. He didn't even have a cabinet picked out for like a month or two. It made no sense, but the consistency of his narrative propelled him into this place. Love or hate Donald Trump, he is a fascinating case study on marketing, on social media, on brand management, on narrative development, on storytelling, on communicating with your base, on being consistent. And that sounds crazy because people would say, well, Donald Trump isn't consistent. He changes his mind all the time. No, what Donald Trump did was Donald Trump was unafraid to change his position, unlike most politicians. But if his through line was, I am not like most politicians, then changing his mind on things publicly on public stages was a thing that most politicians wouldn't do, which added to the consistent narrative of Donald Trump not being like other politicians. It made him feel honest. It didn't make him honest. It made him feel honest. That is emotional truth. That is the kind of stuff that I think is really fascinating. That is kind of what you can do with your own brand if you believe in yourself enough to do it.
So what do you then, you know, a couple more questions and, you know, we'll go, but what do you tell young people? Because what does someone take from all that? Because, you know, both of those examples are, you know, incredible ones, but if I'm 18, what do I take from them?
So it's funny, people have been calling me lately and asking for help with their career, which is weird to me because I'm a lunatic. Like, don't do what I'm doing. Like, there was a couple of years ago where I was eating a loaf of bread every week for food because I didn't have any income. I'm doing better now, but it was a rough time. So if you're not willing to do that, don't follow the me path. But what I will say from all of that is don't let other people define the world you want to live in. Right? Like, if you want to live in a world where you are going to be the greatest fashion designer of all time, do what that requires, right? Go do the fashion design. Kanye West literally was like, I'm going to stop making music, flew to Italy, got some mentor. Now, once again, he's Kanye West. He's got access to other people didn't. But it's not like people were taking him seriously until they did. He went in. Kanye West truly put in the work. There are stories that show like Kanye drew those shoes himself. Like that, like, because he was like a painter as a kid. People keep forgetting this. Kanye was a painter as a kid. Like, he's a really artistic guy, right? And so when people told him, that's the one thing I like about Kanye. Now, Kanye West is a very ill man, like tremendously emotionally unwell. But the one thing about Kanye West is you cannot define for Kanye West what his truth is, right or wrong. If he's going to be the greatest producer of all time, he's going to be the greatest producer. And I use Kanye West because I'm a big fan of his music and some of the stuff that he's done, not some of his actions. But Kanye West, if you follow hip hop in any way, changed the sound and landscape of hip hop music 3 times in his career. First, with the way he used gospel and soul samples. Second, with the way he introduced auto-tune to melody in hip hop. And lastly, the way he kind of melded it with kind of like European techno and all this kind of stuff. And so you get people like Travis Scott. There are sections of hip hop history that everybody at that time were influenced by Kanye West, right? And every time he switched gears, they said, this is not gonna work. You are the soul sample guy. Then he made 808s and Heartbreaks and he made sad songs. Kanye West can't sing. He made a whole album singing. You know, it is that kind of thing that I like to remind people. That it's, yes, being talented is important, but talent comes from work. Like, talent isn't this magical thing that's imbued upon you. It's repetition. You do a thing for so long that you build up a skill set and you continue to do it. Kanye West was making music every day. He was absorbing music every day. He was talking art every day. He flew to other countries and absorbed that all the time. And he did it every single day. So if I'm an 18-year-old, if I'm a 19-year-old, if I'm 16, 17-year-old Eric, back when I was a lazy slouch of a human being and I was coasting by on being a gifted student but not putting in the work that it required to actually have output, I would say, what is the thing that you love? What is the bigger picture? Go get into that. Just go be immersed in it. Because you'll start to absorb it by proximity and by the fact that the drive of great people will either envelop you or expel you. That's what happened to me and my business partner, right? It will either drive me away or I'll be enveloped in it and I will have to meet that level. If you say, I want to be a great fashion designer and your friends aren't fashion designers, I don't know what to tell you. If you're not eating and sleeping and breathing it all the time, I don't know what to tell you. Now, if you want to be a loving family man who works a 9-to-5, once again, equal value. But then go say, what does that require? All right, I need to get a job where I'm making, you know, 80 grand as a chemical engineer. Cool. Let me go do that. Hang around healthy families. Hang around good fathers. Hang around people who don't cheat. Hang around people who don't beat their kids. You know what I'm saying? Hang around people who are the type of people you want to be like. And start to absorb the habits and characteristics of those people. And you'll look up and one day that'll be who you are.
That's fascinating stuff. Well, that's great point. So let me ask you one more thing though. And you know, we've talked about a lot, right? We've talked about, you know, storytelling. We've talked about purpose. We've talked about values and that sort of thing. So if the world had to listen to you for a few minutes, got to ask you this one. If the world had to listen to you for a few minutes, what would you say?
it's an interesting question. I would probably say that's important to remember that in the world that we belong to all of us, right? That our collective goal on earth should be to make the world better for all of us so that our lives are individually improved by the collective whole, right? If we spend a lot of time stopping and starting, going back and burning libraries and all this, you know, burning libraries and Timbuktu and eradicating culture and causing these fights and all this infighting and war and all these cultural divides and all this kind of stuff, when what we should be focused on is trying to figure out how to make all of this better and easier for all of us. If we focused on that goal specifically, not only would no one be hungry, but we would individually be eating better, like better tasting food. We'd have better access to things. We'd be able to travel more. We'd be able to do things that made us all happier. That to me is the crux of all of it. That to me is why I think storytelling is so important. Because the one thing it does do is it allows people to kind of jump out of their reality and into another reality. I feel like if we can make people empathize with, you know, cartoon squirrels and Scooby-Doo, we shouldn't be that far away from making people empathize with Black folks and Asian folks and women. Like we are really down the rabbit hole when people care more about Pixar characters than women. You know, like there are truly people who are more concerned with Tom Brady than their wives, right? And it's just so in the character of Tom Brady, right? Like no one knows Tom Brady, right? But the character of him, that is the storytelling thing. When you've created this emotional connection to a world that you're not even really a part of. I think that is what we should be focusing on with storytelling. I think that is some of the great triumphs of religion. When you see that you can get 1 billion, 2 billion people on a similar accord, maybe not the same accord, but a similar accord to follow a similar message, all the Catholics following the Pope, right? That's incredible, right? From the story created by, you know, wrapped around this guy who was in Jerusalem so many years ago. That kind of stuff to me is the value of all of this. And so if we could just detach from the I need to feel good right now and start to build a world where we are all optimized, right? Where we are all optimized, that people are able to do what they want to do and create stuff. And then let the robots handle the rest, you know? and let automation handle the rest. I mean, I think that's where we are. Like, we don't have to be doing some of this stuff. We're fighting for jobs that people shouldn't even be working just because we refuse to give people universal basic income because we think that people should suffer, right? Like you should work in a coal mine because somebody should have to work. It's like, put some robots in the coal mine. Let that guy go live his best life.
We do hope you enjoyed this podcast. And thanks for listening to What I Wish I Knew with Mike Irwin and Simon Dorr. Please join us at whatiwishiknewshow.com. You can subscribe to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Please share What I Wish I Knew with Mike Irwin and Simon Dorr with your friends. We welcome your feedback and recommendations of new podcast guests and ideas on topics. If you have business challenges, we're also available for advisory and consulting roles. We'd be delighted to listen and help. Just send us an email. Our address is hello@whatiwishiknewshow.com.